Welcome to episode 67 of the Robot Report podcast, which brings conversations with robotics innovators straight to you. I'm Steve Crow, editorial director of the Robot Report. Thanks, folks, as always, for tuning in. Really appreciate it. If you haven't found us yet, if you haven't subscribed, you can find us on all the major podcast platforms, Amazon Music, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, SoundCloud, Spotify. There's probably a million others out there, Mike. Anywhere you get your podcast, you can find us. Joined, as always, by the editor of our robotics group, Mr. Mike Oitzman. What's going on, man?
Hey, Steve. It's going great. You know, we're right here in the midst of a lot of interesting news stories the last couple of weeks, and I think things are starting to heat up with the new year, so it's exciting times.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll have an interview later on in the program today with Jan Becker and Joe Speed from Apex AI. Mike sat down with them recently to discuss some of the mobility software and the challenges when it comes to designing and developing high-speed autonomous vehicles, especially with the race cars at the Indy Autonomous Challenge, the one in Las Vegas. They also did one at the Indy Motor Speedway a few months back.
Right.
But should be a great conversation. Also, I want to thank everybody who submitted presentations for the Robotics Summit. Mike and I and Dan and Brianna and the whole crew really appreciate that. We're knee deep, Mike.
Yeah, it's quite a process.
Process trying to fit everybody in, which, you know, it's impossible to fit everybody in who sent us in submissions wanting to talk at the Robotics Summit and Expo and the Healthcare Robotics Engineering Forum. Both events take place together May 10th to the 11th in Boston. We're reviewing those submissions now. We're almost done. Again, thank you to everybody who sent in ideas, a ton of great ideas about how to move the global robotics industry forward. For those submissions and speakers who we accept, who we want to come talk at the show, hopefully a lot of you guys are listening right now. Just know we'll be in touch sometime next week, probably early to mid next week. We'll be in touch, letting you know that you've been selected as one of the folks that we want to have speak at the show. We'll also be opening up registration for both the Robotics Summit and Healthcare Robotics Engineering Forum very soon as well. So make sure you guys have those events on your calendar. Again, May 10th to the 11th in Boston. We also want to get you guys involved in the show more. We've been talking about this a lot. You can leave us a voicemail on anything that comes to mind related to the robotics industry, challenges, innovations that you see happening for 2022. Respond to some of the interviews that Mike and I have done, something silly that I've said on the show. To do that, super simple. All you got to do is go to the robotreport.com/voicemail. You'll see a voicemail widget right in the middle of your screen. You can leave us a message right from your computer, or if you're on your phone, you can do it from your phone as well. Those messages will get sent to Mike and I directly, and we'll, you know, evaluate it for an upcoming episode of the show. So again, really want to get you guys your voicemails as part of this show. To do that, go to the robotreport.com/voicemail. So Mike, before we get to your interview with Jan Becker and Joe Speed, we do have to recap some of the larger news stories of the last week. And we have a great network of robotic sites to keep everybody updated on the latest news. Check us out at therobotreport.com, roboticsbusinessreview.com, mobilerobotguide.com, and collaborative robotics trends. Mike, good news, bad news. I'm going to let you steer the direction of the show today. You want to start with the good news, or you want to start with the bad news? I'm a glass half empty type of guy, but I know where I'd start. But where do you want to kick things off?
Hey, let's start on a bright note.
Start on the bright side.
Yeah, I'm going for the glass half full. Yeah.
All right. A little out of my comfort zone. So if I'm stumbling here, no. an incredible week for robotics funding.
Right. Yeah.
You know, I don't know. And there's several announcements as you and I are recording this podcast that are out there that we have not yet reported about. But there's probably been close to, I would say, $1 billion raised just this week alone from robotics companies. So we'll run through quickly some of the larger ones. If you have any takeaways, Mike, please share. But again, there's a lot more out there. Maybe we'll get to them by the end of the week. Maybe they'll have to get pushed into late next week, but probably close, if you counted everything, probably close to $1 billion raised just this week alone. Leading the way is Exotech. I believe they're a French company. They develop these ASRS-like systems, and they have a little bit of a different spin compared to some of their competitors, where the mobile robots can actually exit out of the, you know, 3D tower and deliver items to human pickers, or they even have a system called a sky picker, which is a robotic arm that can pick a bunch of different objects. They raised $335 million in Series D funding. They claim that they're now valued at more than $2 billion, which is insane.
That's crazy. Another unicorn, right?
Another unicorn. They're only, and I don't have all the notes in front of me, so I don't know. They're a young company. They haven't been around for all that long, but they're going to use the funding to scale their deployments in North America, Europe, Asia. They only work in e-commerce applications, and they have some major retailers as their customers going forward.
It's a race for this market with the storage and retrieval and e-commerce fulfillment. It's crazy.
Yeah, it's, you know, and some of the funding I'm sure has to do with, you know, an ASRS from Exotech is certainly more expensive to build than say a locust bot, for example. Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. And deploy and maintain and all that kind of stuff. But I love these systems. It seems to make a lot of sense. I think the throughput and the productivity increase is, you probably can't argue with it, right? Which is why these companies are raising so much money, but they're also bringing in a lot of money. Exotech, I had a conversation with them last week. They, you know, AutoStore is their main competitor. We mm-hmm. shared on the robotreport.com. So if you want to find the specific numbers, we'll share them in the show notes. But the revenue that these companies are bringing in is insane. The companies that they work with are leading retailers from around the world. So certainly a market that I've talked about that is one to watch, certainly will be as well going forward.
Well, and being a D round, as you said, of course, this means that the technology is proven. Now this money's going to be used to build the channel and deploy, right? So this is now just a search and destroy mission to knock down all their applications.
And that's a great point. They talked about that. They talked about, again, I might be a little bit off with these, but I think the person I talked to at Exotech said that, you know, last year they sold maybe a system every other month, and, you know, for around $10 million. Now with the ability to hire more folks to deploy more of these systems, they typically work direct with the customer to get these things deployed and installed. They just see they're growing exponentially. The size of the systems, the cost of the systems, the number of systems that they're able to support is just going to go through the roof. So keep an eye out on Exotech. The next biggest round that we've seen so far this week is from an autonomous driving company called Wayve. They raised $200 million in Series B funding. I think they raised $90 million not that long ago, bringing on some major investors. Microsoft joined as an investor. Wayve uses their Azure cloud computing platform to really scale the machine learning technology that they use for their vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
They have Asda and Ocado, which are two leading grocers in the UK, as pilot customers. If you look at just Ocado, for example, you know, Wayve doesn't make cars, they make the driving technology. So Ocado is going to retrofit or outfit some of its delivery vans with the autonomous driving technology from Wayve and test it on last mile delivery in some urban routes. I'm not a technologist, but, you know, the interesting thing about Wayve, I guess, is that they're claiming they can do learning-based autonomous driving, meaning, you know, they don't have to have high-quality maps of the areas in which they're driving, that, you know, their machine learning technology can adapt to the environment on the fly. Mm. They don't use LiDAR. They, you know, take the Tesla approach, and they mainly use cameras to do their driving. But again, a pretty large round from them at $200 million.
Yeah. Yet again, another follow on the whole fulfillment.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, there
part
you go.
Of, yep. Part. Yeah.
This one was very interesting to me. I've never heard of this company, Reliance Retail Ventures. They acquired a majority stake, a 54% stake in Adverb Technologies, another logistics related company, for $132 million. The guy who owns Reliance Retail Ventures, I don't have his name up in front of me, but he's the richest man in Asia, if anybody. Yeah. So an interesting little nugget there.
And Adverb also has an ASRS-like technology as a part of their portfolio. So it's not the only thing they do, but it's a big part of what they do.
Yeah, I'm gonna butcher his name. I apologize. Mukesh Ambani. He's the richest man in Asia. And so he heads up Reliance and really obviously led this investment. So if the richest man in Asia, which was pretty large the last time I checked, if he's dropping $132 million for a 54% stake in your company, I would guess that's a pretty big vote of confidence in that,
right?
you're doing something right and that your technology is one that is much needed. There was a Chinese surgical robotics company that's raised $100 million. They just announced it earlier today. And then, you know, Phantom Auto, which this is a questionable, Mike, robotics investment for me. Phantom Auto, they enable forklifts and other types of warehouse logistics vehicles, manually driven vehicles, to be remotely driven by human beings. So I'm making this up, but, you know, you from your house in California could theoretically remotely zoom in and drive a forklift and say, you know, Boston, where I'm located, right? So,
so I can make some extra money in the evenings.
If you need a, if you need a side hustle, you know, there you go, right? That's the gig economy, isn't that what the, these youngins? I don't know if your daughter's part of that, probably not, but a lot of the younger folks do some sort of side hustle, they call it. But yeah, that's the idea. So there's not really, as far as I understand it, no sort of actual autonomy built into that, but you know, it's a, you often hear with these sidewalk delivery robots that there's teleoperation capabilities when needed. So it's sort of a questionable robotics investment for me, but $45 million, another large round. And then the rounds get a little bit smaller from there. But man, almost $1 billion probably just to, you know, through Thursday of this week. Right. Is an exciting times here for these companies. Now, let's go to the dark side here, my wheelhouse, which is the funding doesn't always mean things work out, right? As we all know.
Yep, it's always a bet, right?
It's always a bet, which is unfortunate, right? And again, I'm starting to come off my hill a little bit. It's getting a little maybe lonely up here on the autonomous vehicle hill. I talked in our 2022 predictions podcast about not a lot of positive developments as far as actual deployments in the U.S. based autonomous vehicle market in 2021. And 2022 is already off to not a very hot start. Again, when it comes to actual deployments, two companies that are working on or were working on autonomous shuttles shut down in just a matter of days, right? I'm going to start with the first one that got shut down because there might be a little bit of confusion. And we may have played into the confusion a little bit about what happened here, but we were trying to be a little bit safe just so that we didn't get anything wrong. Optimus Ride was acquired by a Canadian company called Magna International, a very large company. Now, it's really what it turns out to be is that it's an acqui-hire, but that's because Optimus Ride was going to shut down its business anyway. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Optimus Ride, they designed these shuttles, these level four autonomous shuttles that were designed to operate. Really, they were going after two initial markets: retirement communities and commercial business parks. There's a naval yard, the Brooklyn Naval Yard, I think, was one customer that they went public with a couple of years ago. And the thought there, it makes a lot of sense. Retirement communities, commercial business parks, not a crazy hectic environment.
Controlled environment, private streets, sort of known paths, that type of thing.
You go slow, you drive slow, right? There's a lot of stuff that you can predict that will happen or won't happen.
A good low-hanging fruit, you would think.
You would think so. You know, this. You know, I started calling some folks. I reached out to some former Optimus Ride folks who I knew. You know, they didn't seem to want to talk, but I did talk to someone who would know. And I don't want to name this person, but they said basically the COVID-19 pandemic was horrible for Optimus Ride and its business. And it really makes a lot of sense, right? Especially early on, the COVID-19 pandemic really hit the elderly population especially hard, right? And that's still true today. But early on, think back to March, April, May, June, the early months of 2020 when this nobody really knew what the hell was going on.
No one wanted to leave their house, right?
Yeah. And a lot of the devastating news was for the elderly folks. You think about the nursing homes and then that whole shebang, right? So people in these retirement communities weren't leaving their homes or not as much, right? Mm-hmm. So the autonomous shuttles from Optimus Ride weren't really needed there anymore. Mm. And then if you look at commercial business parks, you know, you and I both work remotely, as does, you know, what percentage of the world does now for the last 2 years. So really their two main environments that they were going after, their main customers, didn't have as big of a need for autonomous shuttles for really the last couple of years, and who knows when they'll need them again.
Right.
Yeah. So it had a major detrimental impact on the business for Optimus Ride. So it was really, I don't know if acquisition is the right word anymore, right? It was basically, hey, Optimus Ride, we're shutting down. We have all these talented engineers in Boston. Magna International is basically hiring those engineers. No, you know, business aspect of Optimus Ride is continuing. They're not going to continue to pursue the development of autonomous shuttles. At least that's what they're saying. Certainly that can change going forward, but it's more of an acqui-hire than anything else. And then the other autonomous shuttle company that shut down was Local Motors. They had been around for a number of years. They've worked on a number of different projects, including an autonomous shuttle called Ollie. They shut down just a couple of days later. It was last Friday, so almost a week ago. But there was they're claiming it was a lack of funding was the reason for their company shutting down. But there was an interesting event that took place up in Canada where one of their shuttles was involved in a really bad accident where it was operating in manual mode, it turns out, but the person driving the shuttle was fatally injured. Now, I didn't know what that term meant, fatally injured, but it's your life was in jeopardy from the injuries that you suffered. So, you know, there was confusion again with that story initially when the shuttle crashed. Was it in autonomous mode? And it was initially reported that that was in autonomous mode when the accident happened. The local police did an investigation and it came out that it actually was not, that it was being manually driven by somebody. But I don't know. The timing doesn't seem like a coincidence to me, right? Hey, we just had this really bad accident up in Canada where they stopped the trial after the accident. And then, you know, maybe a month or 2 months somewhere in that timeline, the entire company shuts down. So it doesn't, maybe it's a coincidence. I don't know. It just, for me, it's kind of hard to believe that that is a coincidence.
And I think it's a warning for all of these types of systems that, you know, one accident can really change your future. So,
yeah, it's, you know, companies like Waymo, you know, Cruise, name some of the other leading robo taxi companies out there right now. Oh, they're not moving fast enough. They're not scaling. They're not, and I'm part of that, right? It's like, oh, why aren't they moving faster? Well, they really shouldn't, right? If it's not, and again, this Local Motors Ollie shuttle was operating in manual mode up in Canada, but it still potentially caused a lot of harm to maybe the future of the company, right? So I think when some of these other companies, Waymo, Cruise, et cetera, are being a little bit extra cautious, it's really the right move.
Right. Yeah.
Sticking with the autonomous vehicle lane, Nuro, they came out kind of surprised everybody with the new R3. They're not calling it R3. They're not following that numeration anymore, but I think they're just calling it the Nuro, their last mile delivery vehicle.
The third iteration of their machine.
Yeah, the third gen of their vehicle. And this is really kind of the interesting thing. I don't know if they're being serious with this. I think they are. I don't know. But they have this airbag, right? on the front of the vehicle. And, you know, it's like any other airbag designed to limit the damage that might occur in a collision. But
well you know, the other option, Steve, is they could put a cow catcher in the front, just like the
Well, isn't it too late though? Like if when is the, unless the sensors, and maybe this is it, it knows that there's no way that we're going to avoid this collision that's going to happen in 2 seconds, 3 seconds or whatever. You know, we need to deploy this airbag immediately. Maybe that's what it is, but it just looks stupid. Does it say, is that the right thing to say? I mean, it just seems
definitely dramatic. Let's go with dramatic.
it just doesn't fit, right? I mean, their vehicle is so well done, has a nice friendly design to it, kind of cartoony a little bit. Very futuristic, and then you stick an airbag on the front of it. And even, you know, I don't know. Maybe it's the whole mindset of, you know, the airbags typically deploy within the vehicle. This one is deploying an airbag outside the front of the vehicle. You know, maybe that's kind of like a mind trick that's going on there. Mm. But anyway, any other stories that stuck out to you, Mike, this week before we get to your interview?
I think the last one, back to our friends in the ASRS space and AutoStore, again, one of the bigger competitors in that space, launched a new vehicle. They're calling this one the R5 Plus. And, you know, when you think about how an ASRS works, it stacks things up in the grid. And they basically could only handle bins of a certain size based on the size of the robot. So this R5 robot is taller. It means it can handle larger bins, which means subsequently it can handle bigger product now to be stored and retrieved. So just a natural evolution for that, of course, but they've launched that. And it means that they can put bigger things in the storage array now.
Absolutely. And we'll have obviously folks to keep everybody updated on everything happening within the global robotics industry. As I said before, we have you covered with our network of robotics sites. You can check us out at The Robot Report, Robotics Business Review, Mobile Robot Guide, and Collaborative Robotics Trends. Mike, you want to set up the interview today that you did with Jan and Joe?
Yeah, great. Our interview today is with Jan Becker, the founder and CEO of Apex.ai, and Joe Speed, who recently joined Apex.ai as the CTO. Some of you might have seen my video interview with Joe at the original India Autonomous Challenge in Indianapolis, where he took us through that vehicle from top to bottom, talked about all of the components. So Joe has left AD Link and has now joined Apex AI, and he'll talk about that in the interview. And for those that don't know Apex, Apex is one of the leading technology sponsors of the recent India Autonomous Challenge competition. And I think Joe is probably one of the biggest evangelists for the competition. He certainly knows everybody involved with it. And so we're going to hear from them who Apex is and a bit about their involvement, a lot about their involvement with the race. So let's listen to that interview now. All right. Well, we're here this morning with two gentlemen from Apex AI. I've got Jan Becker and Joe Speed on the show today. And we're going to talk a little bit about who Apex is and what they're doing. So, Jan, welcome to the show. I'd like you to start by telling us a little bit about how you got involved with autonomous driving research with your career at Stanford, and tell us a little bit about how that research background led to the creation of Apex Software.
Hi, Mike. Good morning. Thanks for having us on the show. I'd be happy to do that. I actually started to work on autonomous vehicles in the late 90s, in 97, actually, when I had finished my master's and I was looking for a PhD position worldwide, and all the ones I had so far seen really didn't sound that exciting. And then I came across one doing autonomous driving, and specifically that was a partially public funded project initiated originally by Volkswagen Research in Northern Germany to automate endurance testing on their test tracks. So they did drive, and I assume they still do drive new cars 24/7 for about a month, driving 10,000 kilometers on a symmetrical test track. And the course is designed such that is equivalent to about 140,000 kilometers in actual real regular road traffic. So they stress vehicles about 14 times in a month, going through the complete mechanical lifetime of a vehicle. Obviously very stressful for the cars, equally stressful for the test drivers. And the goal of that activity was actually to fully automate test driving, which we did. But that was the late 90s, so production sensors didn't exist. We worked with pre-production radar, industrial LiDARs, and pre-production automotive cameras. Even more so, cars didn't have electronically accessible actuators for the gas, for the powertrain, the steering, and the braking. So we built an almost humanoid-like robot to sit on the driver's seat, with which we could then interface electronically. And the robot had three legs for the three pedals, an arm for the gear shifter, another arm for the steering wheel, and even more arms for the levers behind the steering wheel. And while it actually worked beautifully, that robot ended up being more expensive than what Volkswagen wanted to commercially reasonably spend on automating their test track. So it was obviously a great learning experience. And we built up what we would call today level 4, so a fully driverless vehicle for a dedicated area. But it didn't go into production as intended. So that was the late 90s. Then I worked for Bosch in the early 2000s for 4 years, the largest automotive supplier. And we developed what we would today call driver assistance. Back then we called it advanced driver assistance systems. So for instance, we built a level 2 system, so a traffic gen assist, doing both longitudinal and lateral control in traffic jams on highways. We had prototypes running in 2004 and went into a product, a level two system for low speed traffic jam driving in 2015. So over 10 years later. And then we built a left turn assist, prevents you from making unintended left turns just based on a radar sensor, making unintended left turns into oncoming traffic where humans often underestimate the velocity of oncoming vehicles. Similar story, we had a prototype in 2005 and then it took 10, 12 years for it to go into a product in an actual vehicle. So in a very, very long innovation times in the automotive industry. Mm-hmm. And from a software perspective, actually learned back then that an automotive software is often developed three times and there is very little reuse of software. So you build up a prototype, a functional prototype, just to show the functionality. Then you build an initial a product, which then is rebuilt a third time once it goes into an actual product on an embedded system. And then you have very long and innovation times as a result. In 2006, I moved here to the Bay Area, and then I worked at Stanford for 1 year and I actually teach since then. There during the DARPA Urban Challenge, which was sort of the predecessor of the India Autonomous Challenge, so another series of competitions for driverless vehicles.
Great, and it's really incredible to talk about the length of innovation time for technology to make itself into a commercial vehicle, as you described, and it sounds like through that path, you've been building, specific applications, and all of that now has evolved into what Apex has become, which is, a full operating system for the driving autonomous driving computer as an embedded system. That's the path that you're on.
Correct. So then, after the that's exactly the next then also step in my career after the DARPA Urban Challenge. I took responsibility for robotics at Bosch in North America and we came across a company called VeloGarage. VeloGarage was founded around the same time and then ultimately started to develop platforms for robotics, and they built a hardware platform called the PR2 and then a software platform, which then ended up being ROS, the robot operating system. And then my team was actually the first non-academic team. So my lab at Bosch back then was the first non-academic team and the first company to support ROS with a lot of open source software. Mm-hmm. So we, both my co-founder and I, helped build some of the ROS Foundation. Then we used it in a lot of robotics projects at Bosch. Then we rewrote the Stanford autonomous driving code and put it completely on ROS and actually re-open sourced that in, I think, around 2011. Then we saw a lot of company adopt ROS for prototyping for autonomous driving. And we used it a lot at Bosch in until about 2014, 15. But then at the same time, while we saw ROS being able to accelerate a lot of companies in their development and the time from initial idea to prototype was just so much accelerated by enabling reuse of software. So, not everybody needs to develop their own tools anymore. There is one common tool for recording data, for playback data, for visualization, for data inspection, the whole data communication and orchestration of a complex software is being done by ROS. So that saves a tremendous amount of upfront development time. But then at the same time, we saw we at Bosch, we got stuck taking ROS software into a more robust, reliable environment. And, ultimately even doing autonomous driving, you drive sometimes with highway speeds. So you need a very reliable, and then for putting it into a product, ultimately also safety certified software. Right. So we got stuck doing that with ROS. We saw a lot of other companies getting stuck at the same point, and we're tracking over 100 companies using ROS in development. And that then ultimately was the starting idea for Apex AI, where we got stuck using ROS in a robust environment, and we saw a lot of others getting stuck. So we thought, hey, let's build on what works great in ROS, and then let's improve what wasn't working great at the time, which was A, the architecture in ROS 1, and then the foundation of the company, Apex CI, in 2017, coincided with the release of ROS 2, which then has actually a much, much cleaner, better structured architecture. The middleware part, so the data communication part, got spun out and then adopted DDS, a standard for which also open source implementations exist. And Joe is going to talk about that later. And then we really just improved on what wasn't working well in ROS, which is the real-time and the reliability and ultimately the safety certified part. So this is what we've done at Apex AI. We've rewritten ROS2 to the degree that we put it on real-time kernels. We took out all the static memory allocation to make it, all the dynamic memory allocation to make it static and thereby real-time and reliable. And we spent most of the pandemic to then take it through functional safety certification, which we've now achieved with Apex OS. It's fully ISO 26262
ASL-D
certified.
Wow. Well, that's quite a path that you've been on, Jan. And we're going to come back and talk a little bit later in the conversation about the next step on the IAC race, which is coming up later this week. Before we do that, though, I wanted to bring Joe in the conversation. And Joe, it's fun to catch up with you again after our interview a few months back at Indianapolis in the inaugural IAC race. And since then, you've joined Apex. So tell us a little bit about that decision and the potential you see at Apex. What's impressed you most about the technology and the roadmap that Apex is on?
Hi, Mike. Great to talk to you again. Always a pleasure.
Yeah.
So Apex is a company I've been working with them for years and big fan. And I had asked my wife years ago, I said, like, you know, these people are like, what they're doing is so important. Like, I would love to join them. And at the time, you know, my wife had had enough of me, you know, doing startups. So she was like, no, you can't join them, but just, you know, be their friend, help them, support them. You don't have to join the company to support their mission. And that's what I've been doing for several years now. And then when we got closer to Thanksgiving, she actually gave me the head nod and said that I could do it. So I let them know and joined, and very excited to be here on board. The work that they've been doing, so, you know, the work that Jan, Dayan, the rest of the team, you know, helping bring about ROS2, forking it to make a functionally safe, real-time, deterministic, commercial ROS2 distro. The upstream contributions to make ROS better, the upstream contributions to the open source middleware that Apex AI is working with. You know, these are all incredibly important things. And, you know, I've been here involved in the ROS community for some years now, was on the ROS2 technical steering committee with Apex AI, working on all this. And, you know, I'm a car guy, right? You know, I love things that roll. I've spent a number of years working on, you know, autonomous people movers and autonomous mobility for the elderly and disabled and all of these kinds of things. And although with the India Autonomous Challenge, it was fun to get back into things that go fast. So, you know, I'm a gearhead, and I love sports cars and things. You know, did a open source Internet of Things supercharged Jaguar F-Type concept car back in the day, and, you know, all these fun things. And, you know, and then I veered into these autonomous people movers, which is incredibly important work, but, you know, they go 5 miles an hour, 10 miles an hour, 15 on a good day. And so now, you know, working with Apex AI this past year and the India Autonomous Challenge, and, you know, now we're talking about it's open source that goes you know, the Italians are very fast. So Polymove, using code contributed by Apex AI and the rest of the community, you know, 157 miles an hour top speed.
Right.
Euro racing, University of Modena and others with 139 mile an hour lap. And then TUM, which Apex has supported all of the Indy Autonomous Challenge teams, but with, you know, Dayan being an alumni of the Technical University of Munich, TUM has a very special place in our heart and has gotten a lot of personal attention. And so we'll talk about that as well.
Yeah, it's good to know that little backstory with the connection with TUM. So Jan, you gave us a bit, talk about the backstory. You gave us the history of the company. Now talk a little bit about looking forward. What's your vision for the future of autonomous driving and the role of Apex in helping to accelerate that pace of innovation and the maturing of the software stack and autonomous vehicles, as you said, from a commercial perspective, to make it usable, to make it safe, and of course, to push the limit. It's now to where they need to be so that we can get to where, you know, that point where we all want to get to, which is level 5 autonomous driving at some point in the future. Mm-hmm.
So let me actually start by saying that our scope goes way beyond just autonomous vehicles. So ROS, in the meantime, since its inception 15 years ago, has penetrated not just autonomous driving. That's how both I started and we started as a company. But we see application in level 2 vehicles, even in driver assistance, in infotainment systems. We see applications beyond passenger vehicles in trucks, in mining, in people mover. We've received inquiries from medical robotics companies, service robotics companies. As I'm sure you're aware, the applications are go way beyond just vehicles. And Airbus, for instance, was one of our earlier investors a couple of years ago, and they're looking at aerial vehicles and not just ground vehicles. So and then we even go beyond, for instance, into IoT applications. So ultimately, anywhere where data from sensors, typically larger amounts of data, are being read into a computer system, then processed with typically on multi-core CPU, many-core accelerator machines, and then the processing requires either performance guarantees or safety guarantees or real-time guarantees or all of those. That's where ROS finds users could receive a benefit from using a standardized system like ROS, and we then provide the real-time, reliable, and ultimately safety-certified solution. So having that said, yeah, we go way beyond just autonomous driving, but obviously our roots are in autonomous driving. Mm-hmm. And we have a number of customers working on level 4 vehicles.
Great. I also want to congratulate you and the team on closing your recent Series B round of financing. I know that's important to your future. So can you tell us what that means for the company and how you plan to use that investment to grow in the coming year or two?
Sure. And that's actually an excellent example. So the Series B is an excellent example on the breadth and wide applicability that industry sees in our software.
Right.
So two of the largest suppliers invested in our Series B round. That's ZF and Continental, both in Germany. And there you can see that they obviously think that they can sell solutions that are based on ROS, so through Apex OS, to OEM customers, and they make money not just with level 4, but also with driver assistance, so level 1 and level 2 systems, and going also beyond driver assistance into, for instance, infotainment systems. So there is the really wide applicability beyond just autonomous driving. Then Echo, an agricultural company, doing tractors and agricultural automation invested there. We obviously have applicability of our software beyond the core automotive domain. And then Airbus, Jaguar Land Rover, Volvo Group, Toyota and Hella also invested in our Series B. There we really have a world-class group of investors going from OEMs to truck manufacturers, to suppliers. And we couldn't be more happy. So what are we going to do with the Series B? So we will go beyond automotive, but we will also go beyond our current markets regionally, which is we are currently planning expanding to Asia. Just as one example.
Great. Well, let's talk about sort of the big event for this week. Of course, CES is happening in Vegas, and along with that came the announcement of yet another round of the Indy Autonomous Challenge. This is round two, which is going to take place at the Las Vegas Speedway on Friday of this week. And I know you guys are both excited about that event and the role that Apex is playing in that. So, Joe, you've been a champion of embedded systems, and you were one of the key advocates for the technology stack that is in the middle of the Indy Autonomous Challenge race cars. We talked about that during our last interview. And we also talked about, you know, some of the things involved with, you know, the limitations and processing the sensor fusion with all of the great sensors that are in these vehicles. And now, of course, you're representing Apex in this conversation. So tell us a little bit about, you know, what this next, what folks should expect to see, what type of things we expect to you know, happen technology-wise in pushing the limits with the event on Friday.
Sure. Yeah, so the Autonomous Challenge at CES is happening January 7th. That is for the show attendees. They'll be able to go to that in person. So you go and add it to your schedule in the CES app, and they'll have buses going from West Hall, taking everyone over to the Las Vegas Motor Speedway. So right. CES and the Indy Autonomous Challenge, they've worked with Las Vegas Motor Speedway to have the speedway for the universities for the past month to do track days, so practice days for all of the teams. And so they're getting that really dialed in. Also, the LG's Silicon Valley Lab has developed the Las Vegas Motor Speedway as a racetrack asset in simulation. So the teams have been working with that. So that's written in Unity 3D. They also have the Dallara AV21 race car as an asset. So they've been working on with all this to get ready. So what's different this time is that you're going to have more than one car on the track at a time. And So they're setting this up as basically a passing competition. So being able to prove the teams passing one another on the track, which we didn't get at Indy. You know, the original vision of this was that for the Indy Motor Speedway, Indy Autonomous Challenge back in October, we'd have all the cars, all the teams on the track at the same time, head-to-head racing. But frankly, COVID happened. So in COVID, you know, it means a lot of things. So one is, you know, I think we've all heard about the disruption of supply chain. Well, race cars are not immune to that. And So what we were supposed to have is the first car delivered back in last January with all the break-in testing, the track times, we could build all the remaining cars and deliver the entire fleet of cars to the universities at the Indy 500 in May. Mm-hmm. And it was delayed. And so, you know, some teams didn't receive their race car until 2 weeks before the IEC race. So that's why it ended up changing from a head-to-head race to time trials. So fastest two-lap average, fastest top speed, fastest lap speed. And so now with, you know, the race at CES is coming fast on the heels, right? Because they just wrapped up the Indy Autonomous Challenge October, in late October, and now we're already on to the race here in Vegas. And so we will have multiple cars on the track, and then there will be more events later this year. And so that's where we start to get into more of the head-to-head racing. So head-to-head racing will happen. It just doesn't happen on schedule, just like everything else during this this time of COVID. So with us, with Apex AI, you know, we've talked before about the base vehicle software, right?
Like, yeah, right.
You know, once upon a time, the organizers of ND Autonomous Challenge had this idea that we're going to build these physical cars, hand them out to universities, and wish them good luck. And I knew from my experience that that wasn't going to, there's something more was needed. And right. So, you know, myself, Gene O'Connell, Alex from Tomb, and others, we all banded together and created the IAC Base Vehicle Software Working Group, which produces the IAC Base Vehicle Software. So this is a reference implementation, a stack for all of the teams. Mm-hmm. And Apex has been a big contributor to the software used in that stack, but also a direct contributor to improvements, innovations specific to the ND Autonomous Challenge. So that IAC-based vehicle software stack that, you know, it's an open contest. So teams can use anything they want, right? Yeah. And so, a year ago, all the teams were using commercial software and in their stack. And by the time we got to Indy, all the teams had actually switched to using free open source software that Apex AI contributes to. So that is the ROS 2 with the ROS middlewares, the Eclipse Cyclone with the Azov Galactic with the built-in Isorox zero copy. And we'll talk a bit about why that matters for this kind of sensor suite. And that's, you know, supported and contributed by all the community.
Right. And I think that what I found interesting, Joe, through all of this, and Jan, you can add your opinion to this as well, is the concept here was that you didn't want to hand the universities just a blank sheet of paper and let them start from scratch to pull this all together. The reference implementation, as you talked about, helped get everyone down the road, as you said, Joe, to be able to run a yellow lap at 60 miles an hour, was everybody could actually get the vehicles out of the paddock and on the track and moving quite quickly. But not only that, as you also stated, there were some simulation races earlier in the year, and the COVID pushback on the actual final race meant that there was the next additional 12 months of effort here that was done in simulation. And that's in that simulation environment was the same software stack, the same algorithms pulled and actually put into the car. So all of this concept of simulating sensor input to calculate and get, you know, the algorithms actually functional was done in simulation and then brought into the real world. And I think, Jan, as you talked about earlier, you see this as the path forward for a lot of commercial vehicles to be able to get down the path faster, to simulate edge cases, to get the safety stuff figured out without putting real hardware and real humans at risk. So maybe you can talk a little bit about how you see that as you know, supporting the faster evolution as we move forward.
Of course. And so overall, what I think we've all realized as a community over the past, 5, 6, 7 years, is that building an automotive software stack, and even more specifically, a level 4 or 5 autonomous driving software stack, is just an incredibly large and huge task mm-hmm. to complete. And what we've now seen are really two approaches to sort of limit that complexity. One is a very, very narrow and use case specific vertical integration. This is mm-hmm. some of what some of the level 4 companies have now attempting to do, obviously. And then the other one is, and then you can own the whole vertical integration, but for a very specific use case and the one very specific sensor set and one very specific hardware set. And then the other approach is to do a horizontal integration where you have different entities, different companies, different solution providers build horizontally integrated components. And that's exactly what we do for the base software layer part. So for the part that originates from Rust, we've built a fully safety certified, real-time reliable solution of Rust. And that since Rust is really the only widely accepted and open source platform, but it's an obviously having an open architecture, that's actually a great solution for having such a generic platform. Mm-hmm. And it's actually the only open architecture solution that has found acceptance in industry. We've seen dozens of different initiatives over the past few years to get to a software-defined vehicle, to start new open source projects. None of that has actually worked because it's way too late to introduce a new architecture and a new solution. Companies have either built their own or they've built on Rust and they may have modified Rust a little bit, but that's really the only widely applicable, widely accepted solution out there. And then obviously it makes total sense for the Indie Autonomous Challenge to also base on that solution, because nobody makes progress building everything from scratch again, but really people make progress by building on top of what already works and then improving what doesn't work and customizing it and tailoring it to the specific use case, which in this case is driving at race speeds on a track.
Yeah. Well, maybe one way to wrap this all up in terms of what we should be looking for, at the race on Friday, is to come back to this conversation about sensor fusion. What's happening really when you're going 180 miles an hour with a concrete wall a few yards to one side of you, and now trying to identify and calculate the path around a vehicle in front of you at those speeds, much different certainly than 30 miles an hour on a city street, right? So talk to us a little bit about, where we're going to hit some of the limits here from a processing perspective and how that's going to help evolve this technology and why you see this as a great investment for our future.
Yeah, the rate of speed is kind of an interesting one, because if your perception pipelines aren't fast enough, instead of showing you where you're going, it's going to tell you where you've been.
Yeah.
So it is a bit of a challenge, right? You start talking about, on a good day, your AMRs, your AGVs and warehouses and factories are doing 1 meter per second, 1.5 meter, 2 meters, right? And, we start talking about 60 meters a second plus, it's a real issue. And so some of the contributions that Apex AI has been doing, especially things like Cyclone DDS with the built-in ISROX. So ISROX is a zero copy shared memory PubSub implementation. And what's interesting about it for these automotive use cases is autonomy, driver's assistance, these things, they really depend on the high bandwidth sensors, right? So the IAC race car has 6 cameras running it up to 150 frames per second. It's got 3 Luminar flash LiDARs. So 120 degrees each, all 3 together, gives you a full 360. And when you take all of these together, it's a lot of bits that you're having to move around. And if you're trying to copy them, like with the normal kind of PubSub implementation, it's just too heavy, too slow. So the latency cost, the CPU cost is too much. So what we have done with this ISROX integrated into the ROS middleware for the vehicles is that regardless of message size, so whether it's a kilobyte or a megabyte, it has a known fixed cost. So a fixed cost in terms of latency in microseconds and a fixed cost in terms of CPU cycles. And so that's really what makes it possible to do the ingestion and dissemination of this kind of sensor data and to enable the sensor fusion that's required for things like, you know, not putting it into a wall if one of the sensors fail.
Right.
So that's going to be a key thing. In terms of the top speed, so the vehicle is absolutely designed and built for 180 plus miles per hour. We are in Vegas in January, and despite it being sunny and clear, people forget it's cold. We're running on tires that don't even begin to warm up until 120 miles per hour. And we'll definitely have speeds over 100 miles per hour. Let's see how fast we can push it. But it'll be interesting. It'll be interesting to see.
That's a whole different science and a whole different aspect of motor racing is that tire track temperature and all the rest. So you're right. That alone will limit some of the speeds, regardless of all the technology things we just talked about from a processing perspective. And imagine these guys have enough on their plate just to get around even at the lower speeds without having to push it. You know, we're not trying to be the first one across the line here. I imagine it's just a technology demonstration at this level. And we're looking forward to, you know, the next evolution. It's great that this autonomous challenge now looks like it's going to be a multi-event. So we've got lots of things to look forward to, and I'm sure you guys have lots of things to look forward to from a evolution perspective as well, as you learn from the teams as they continue to break things. Certainly, hopefully not race cars, but certainly hit the limits on things, and that just makes you guys work harder too.
Well, your solution. And that really is the brilliant thing about this challenge is. The cars are a laboratory, the racetrack is a laboratory, and there is no risk, right? Like, you know, there's risk of property damage, sure, but you know, you crash a car, we build another one. But there's no risk to humans. And, you know, where else are you going to get these, you know, close-in situations, the high speeds, and being able to do this. And I'll tell you, you know, the innovation's coming out already. The team's TUM open sourcing. So I've mentioned that, you know, TUM had a special place in Apex AI's heart. So Apex AI supported all the teams, but gave a lot of personal attention and assistance and guidance to TUM. And the result of that, we can't take the credit, but I'll just say this. Apex AI gave personal attention and assistance to TUM, and then TUM went and won the Indy Autonomous Challenge in Indianapolis. And so now, you know, we're giving that kind of attention to all the teams. And so they're innovating, they're doing upstream contributions, they're open sourcing their work. And these students, as they enter industry, they're going to bring these innovations and skills with them. Mm-hmm. So this is very much just like, you know, how the DARPA Grand Challenge was the catalyst that kicked off modern autonomous driving. Right. You know, we see the Indy Autonomous Challenge as like that next wave of how do you create more performant controllers? How do you enable higher speed sensor fusion to support these close-in driving and higher speed of operation. And so, you know, we're helping contribute to that. We benefit from it. The community benefits from it. And we're hiring. So, you know, you asked Jan what we're going to do with all of this investment and funding from industry. Big part of it is we're hiring. And so anyone working in this space, just reach out, contact us, contact me. We are hiring.
Great. Well, Joe, thanks again for giving us a in-depth view under the hood, look under the hood at what's going to happen on Friday at the race. Jan, thank you for giving us a perspective about your history and your organization and your view and an investment of this interesting research project, but I really think it's going to push the industry forward. So thank you for having that vision and the work that you're doing to push us forward from autonomous vehicle perspective.
Thanks, Mike, for having us.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right, Steve, just as a sidebar to the interview, because it was recorded a few weeks ago, and as you heard, it was leading up to the actual Autonomous Challenge event at CES, and the ultimate winner of that event was Polymove, one of the university teams who came in probably, I think they came in second in Indianapolis, but they did two things during that event that are significant. The first one is they set a new land speed record during that week of CES with a speed of 175.96 miles per hour. And they went and did that out in the desert at one of the desert test tracks. So that was fascinating. And then they also went on to win the event with an on-track speed of 167 miles per hour while passing the team from TUM. And man, it was just a fascinating and exciting event to watch. This was really exciting to see those vehicles on. And so overall, just a great event and has raised the bar for where this goes in the future.
What's next?
Do you know, they haven't announced, but everybody's hinting that this isn't done. So there will be another event. And as you know, as we saw at CES, there were two vehicles on the racetrack at a time. They were doing, you know, subsequent passing drills, if you want to call it that, to demonstrate the speeds. And you know, 167 now is racing speeds. That's the speeds you're going to need to go if you're going to want to win an event. So I would imagine the next event's going to happen here next 6 to 9 months. Who knows where yet? Maybe it's back at Indianapolis. Maybe they move it somewhere else in the world. Could go anywhere in the world, essentially. I think that we're going to see this continue. And as we've talked to folks at TUM and Alex, who started DriveBlocks, you know, the whole thing here is just keeps building. You know, now they'll take this base level of code. All the teams will start to work on a certain base level of code and push the next through the next boundary, which now is multiple cars and actually racing, you know, from the starting line to the finish line. I think we're going to get there in the next, you know, year, maybe two.
I'm about an hour or so away from the New Hampshire. Is it the New Hampshire Motor Speedway?
Yeah.
I don't know if that's the actual name of it, but tell Joe, tell Jan, tell anybody else involved in that to bring it up there and
great.
Make it easy for me.
All right.
Well, that's awesome. Great stuff there. And we'll obviously track whatever's next for the Indy Autonomous Challenge. Again, I want to thank everybody who submitted presentation ideas to the Robotics Summit and to the Healthcare Robotics Engineering Forum. Again, as we said off the top of the show here, we're reviewing those submissions. We should be done by the end of this week. And we'll be in touch with folks to let you know whether or not you were selected to speak at the show early next week. So early in the week of January 24th, you should hear from us one way or another. But really appreciate it. Really, really appreciate it. And then registration will follow not too long after that. Again, Robotics Summit and Expo. Healthcare Robotics Engineering Forum, all about moving the global robotics industry forward, how to design and develop more effective commercial robotic systems, takes place May 10th to 11th in Boston, and hope to see everybody there. Again, we want to get you guys involved in this show. We want to make it interactive. You can leave a voicemail that Mike and I might play on an upcoming episode of the show. Super simple to do. Go to therobotreport.com/voicemail. You'll see the voicemail widget right there on your screen. You can leave us a voicemail right from your computer, right from your phone, if you're browsing on your phone. Again, anything that comes to mind about the global robotics industry, challenges, opportunities, interesting companies, interesting technologies, Mike and I would really love to hear from you. So go to therobotreport.com/voicemail, and maybe we'll play your voicemail on an upcoming episode of the show. And if you haven't subscribed to us, you can find us on all the major podcast platforms. We have new episodes every single week. You can find us on Amazon Music, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, SoundCloud, Spotify, anywhere you get your podcast. On behalf of Mike Boitzman and the entire crew, I'm Steve Crow. Thanks, folks, for tuning in to episode 67 of the Robot Report podcast. We'll talk to you next week.